I run into people from time to time who will tell me that, and I look at them and say, well, you may think that's the right way to go, but you need to think about that. And it's because the government sector is such a different sector. And Tom, I grew up in Detroit, and my dad and everybody I knew was either with the auto companies or selling to the auto companies. And I can tell you, my dad, who was a salesperson, would never have thought of suing GM or Ford if he lost a deal with them. You just sharpen your pencil. You take more people to lunch in those days, but you didn't sue them.
With martinis.
With martinis, that's right, and more than one, that's right. And but with the U.S. government, it's a totally different world. And sometimes the only way you can get back in the ballgame after you've lost is to file a protest. And so taking an extreme position, we should never protest or we'll never protest or we'll always protest, both are that's just not a smart way to approach this business. You got to look at each situation on its facts, understand the rules, and when you should take a shot at getting back in the game.
But when you look at the statistics of contracting actions versus the number of protests every year, in fact, very, very few companies actually do protest.
Well, that's true. However, if you just really the best statistics we have on protests are with the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, which is now handling about 2,500 protests a year. And you're right. Compared to the number of contract actions out there, that's low, which is good. And actually, that was the entire purpose when the statutes were one of the big purposes when the statutes were redone on procurement in the mid-1990s. That is to lower the number of protests out there. And that has worked, and it's worked well. There are a number of factors that go into that. But still, 2,500 protests is a lot of protests.
And most of them do end up in favor of the agency, correct?
Correct. Again, statistically at the GAO, about 60% the agency is going to prevail. Now, when I broke into the business in the early 1970s, I can tell you that the government probably won 94% of the protests. But the laws changed in the early 1980s, and the process has changed as a result of it. And so now the success rate at the GAO, statistically, again, that's where we capture the best data, is the effectiveness rate, as I've talked about in this myth, is about 30%. And so you got to look at that. That's pretty good compared to what it used to be when all the government had to do to come in to the GAO and it was to come in and say, we disagree with the protester, and that was enough for GAO to rule in the government's favor. Those days are gone. So if you've got roughly a 30% shot when you go on to a protest, when you file a protest, that's worth thinking about.
Back then, we had the Brooks Act, and then that was followed by the Competition and Contracting Act. So it's mainly the Competition and Contracting Act that gave rise to the protest idea as we understand it today.
Before the Competition and Contracting Act, you are correct. The rules just weren't set up to be friendly to protesters. But since then, since 1982 or so, the world has changed.
And so now we have the Clinger-Cohen era, which surpassed the Brooks Act. That created the idea of, or at least it furthered the idea of agency discretion and also best value. And so maybe that's why there's a little bit more ambiguity in the way awards are made, perhaps.
Well, you've touched on it. It's not really the ambiguity. They just have so much more discretion. If you look at the way the regulations have been rewritten as a result of the Clinger-Cohen Act in the mid-1990s, the discretion accorded to the agencies is just tremendous. And they can drive a truck through it, is what we like to say. And they do. And so what we have to warn our clients when they're asking us about a protest is, look, some of these things are very discretionary, and the government has the benefit of the doubt. You have to prove what they've done is arbitrary and capricious. It's not the same standard as a dog bite case, which is preponderance of the evidence. You've got to show that they were arbitrary, capricious, irrational. That's tough to do at the GAO or at the claims court.
We're speaking with Tim Sullivan. He's a partner at Thompson Coburn. So what do you advise clients as to when they should protest? When do you know, hey, this is a really good case here we might have?
Well, actually, the way if you read the myth number one, which is what you and I are talking about, it kind of lays out the steps that smart contractors take. And what will generally happen, see, the protests arise in two contexts. One is the solicitation itself, what we call the pre-proposal protest. And In that situation, you're looking at the solicitation, the RFP usually, the request for proposal, and you see something that's a real problem. Either it favors one company over everybody else, or there's a huge contradiction in there that you can't resolve by using what's called the order of precedence clause in the solicitation. And you got to go to the agency and raise this before offers are due. And if you don't, and here's what happens, Tom, many companies say, oh, no, we're not going to file a protest before we submit our proposal. Let's just put that issue in our back pocket, see if we win. And then if we don't win, now we've got a protest issue. And as I point out in the myth, every government lawyer out there knows that's a loser for a protester, because GAO and the Court of Federal Claims have ruled hundreds of times that if something was apparent from the face of a solicitation, you've got to raise that issue in a protest before offers are due. So that's a knockout punch. And so that's the first kind of protest, challenging what's in the solicitation. And that can arise under a number of different factual scenarios. But it's always when you look at it and realize that you've got a competitive disadvantage and you've got to do something about it.
So that could be when an agency says, for example, this brand name or equivalent.
Well, yeah, brand name or equal is one, although agencies can do that if they've dotted their I's and crossed their T's. But as an example, we saw one 4 or 5 years ago where the only way you could get an exceptional for past performance was if you were the incumbent. Now, that's not what it said, but it said something like, to get an excellent, you've got to have done this very same work for the past 3 years. And so anyone trying to come in to unseat the incumbent was already at a disadvantage. And you've got to challenge that beforehand.
In that case, the vendor wasn't even wiring it. It was the agency that kind of did the wiring by themselves.
Right. And it's indicative of what will happen, Tom. These contracting officers are busy people. And while they'd like to tell you that they are able to read every solicitation that goes out and read every word of it and parse it, that's just not true. They're busy. And so they rely on their technical people to do the right job in terms of many of the clauses and requirements that go into an RFP. And sometimes these things get through. Believe me, they get through. And that's, we really sort of rely on the competitors out there to keep the system, I don't want to say honest, but to make sure this stuff doesn't last very long if it gets out there. They'll scream when they see these kinds of things.